Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Carulla. We have a legend in the studio today for another quarantine episode of Wake Up Hollywood, Mr. Matt Fink, a.k.a. Dr. Fink from Prince and the Revolution. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing pretty well. considering all of this, more isolation than usual. But lately I've been getting out more because the claustrophobia was beginning to set in, and winter is coming today. Minneapolis got anywhere between like 7 and 11 inches of snow today.
Already?
Yes. What? Yes. That's today, it's freaking insane. Totally rare. At this time of year, usually, right. You know, we'll see it by mid-November.
That's what I usually expect.
So it's kind of like a month early, literally, almost a month early. And for this much to fall, too, in one day, heavy, wet snow, very unusual. And here we are. It's 2020. I believe that it's just par for the course. Where this is something we, as humanity, has to experience this year. It's a very important year for us all. And we have a lot of important decisions to make coming up here.
Of course. And I know you and I see the world in a lot of the same ways. We've talked about some of this stuff. But this year has been crazy with all of the pandemic stuff. How has that affected you as far as creatively? Do you find yourself more creative, less creative, just being, you know, having more time to be at home?
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing. I moved into this house literally 25 years ago, and I've worked in isolation here quite a bit, so it's nothing new to me. But it's right. What's unusual is the inability to go out and see a movie, go to a restaurant properly, socialize with friends, all that. It's really beginning to wear on me. I don't know about you.
Oh, you know, I've been telling everybody this. It's like, when I'm working on music or when I'm in my room, it's like business as usual. The weird part is when I go outside and I see that the whole world is also in their rooms, respectively.
Yes.
It's just like a totally dead energy. No. It's depressing. It's definitely depressing.
Yeah.
I find it a little odd.
But with that said, I've been getting out more with the mask and being less fearful, but at the same time, being very cautious because, you know, I know people that have gotten this and it's not great.
Yeah. Right.
It's not great. So I'm a little concerned. It's very stressful in that respect. But as far as work, creativity, that's been okay. I'm really busy doing this, you know, working with this company that I've come on board with about 4.5 years ago.
Right.
And that's taken up a lot of my time. There's been creative moments in there all the way around, too, in music. But at the same time, it's been business, too, more oriented than doing music, too. You know, like sitting in the studio and playing. So it's a mixture. It's a good mixture. I like it. I'm enjoying it quite a bit, actually.
Well, what's awesome too, it's like, you know, you came through such a renaissance of creativity in the 80s. I mean, there was so much music and soul music and rock music and kind of like this resurgence of so many different genres. And you were kind of watching all of that unfold. And then now you see that everything's kind of like an inward reflection of, you know, so it's just like such a dichotomy from kind of some of the things that you've experienced. How do you feel it, you know, like the Minneapolis music scene is being affected by this whole pandemic?
Just horrendously. Everybody's affected horrendously right now. And I'm going to do my damnedest to raise funds here soon. I really want to do more. I know we did some things earlier, but it didn't take a lot of effort because we didn't have to perform. This was the Revolution event that took place, and they showed the 1985 Purple Rain live concert from Syracuse, New York show. And they raised that organization. I don't know. I can't remember. It was a lot. It was millions. It was in the millions. And it was viewed by several million people too. So that makes me feel good when something I did in the past was a group effort, as a team effort with Prince, can come forward and help to raise money to help our fellow artists. So,
well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how you got in the Revolution, how you came across Prince, because you know it's really rare that any musician gets to be a part of like a real movement, and you were a part of one of the most creative and essential movements in music. It's something that still inspires me almost on the daily. So just tell me a little bit about like how you got into music, how you got into the Revolution, and how you started working with Prince.
Well, I have to thank my parents for giving me the opportunity to delve into music and theater both, because they were both into those things as well in a big way, but more so the theater, because that's where their heart would lie. They both studied theater and music. My dad played piano, my mom played a little piano, but they really did mostly acting. As I was a child growing up, they were doing plays and heading community theaters and, you know, other professional theaters that were in Minneapolis. Really cool. And my mom, she had her own voiceover talent agency called Beyond Words for many years that she ran and booked.
That's a clever name. I like that a lot.
Beyond Words. Yep. And then my father, you know, he ran an advertising specialties company while he was doing the acting and voiceover work on the side as well.
You saw them really do the hustle as artists from an early stage.
Exactly. And then, you know, they just said, your older brother's taking piano now. Do you want to get into it? My brother was like three grades ahead of me. And I started playing piano when I was about six or so.
Wow.
And had a teacher, you know, playing Mary Had a Little Lamb, the usual. You start out simple. By the time I was 12, I was playing what was called the 12 Variations of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star by Mozart for my recital. And I'll never forget it because Mozart was 12 when he wrote that.
Right.
I mean, in those days, artists didn't have television to distract them. They didn't have the radio. They didn't have record players. They didn't have anything to do except eat, sleep, and drink the instrument. And that was it. So by the time this prodigy is 12, he's writing this amazing piece. By the time you get to the 12th variation, it's insane. It's like playing, you know, like some complex, wild piano piece. Of course, I couldn't do all 12 at the recital because it would have taken too long. So I skipped through several of them on purpose to get to the 12th one. And I performed that same thing at the age of 12.
And were you like a stickler about practicing, or was it kind of like a drag when you?
No, I was lazy. Oh my God. Most kids were. Most kids were lazy. Sheesh. You know, if I hadn't had TV, and thank God we didn't have video games, I would have never gotten anything done. But you know, if I had had that, hadn't had TV and like Mozart, I probably would have gone further as a concert pianist, because my father, he really wanted me to become a classical concert pianist in reality, or an orchestra conductor for classical music. He actually expressed that to me more than once. And I just said, oh, yeah, I love that. But, Dad, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan when I was 6 years old. It was my sixth birthday, literally the day after.
Oh, you gave me chills, man.
And my parents summoned me in to watch, because we watched Ed every Sunday, right?
Right.
So we all watched that.
That was a religious thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we all watched it every, that was all that was on Sunday night. It was the best show. So Beatles came on. I was six. I went, what the heck is this?
And had you heard of them before, or was it just
No, it was a total surprise. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know they were coming on, who they were. Because I was six, I wasn't in the media, like, keeping up with the news yet. You know, like, who's coming into America, New York? The Beatles arrived. You know, none of that was there. So I just was enamored. And then we had little teeny, like, transistor radios that my dad brought home from his office, because he'd get them and he was selling those as part of his advertising specialties line. And it's the new Japanese transistor radio. It's such a fad. You know, think of it. It was the Walkman of its day, really.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So I would go to bed at night with my brother, because we shared the same room at that time, at that age, in that house. And we would listen to the radio, local radio station, to all the artists that were happening in the day. And the Beatles were on, and I just couldn't wait to hear, you know, Please Love Me Do and Please Please Me and all those
songs.
Great song. Oh, my God. So that was it. I was off and running with the British invasion and all the other, I mean, Motown, because I loved all of it, really, because, you know, we'd watch Ed Sullivan see the Supremes and all those
people.
You see
behind me, this is my wall of Paul. This is all Paul McCartney. I got to meet him, and he signed a ticket stub for me right there. So
there
I'm right
go.
There with you with Beatles, man. Beatles were everything.
So for me, a dream came true last year. In November, when I was able to participate in the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp Beatles edition.
Oh, wow.
And I was one of the counselors. And at the end of the final night of the whole week of the event of working with everybody, we all performed with Cheap Trick and did the whole Sgt. Pepper album.
That's awesome.
Oh, my God. It was like the most amazing night I've ever had, other than playing with Prince. It was the most.
I was like, wait a minute.
No, it was. We had so much fun. And you had all these people that were from the Beatles thing and Wings and stuff showing up and being talking and performing with us and stuff. It was just so much fun. I can't tell you. So anyway, after that event, the head of the event, David Fischoff, who founded that whole thing, approached me and said, what do you think about doing a Prince camp in Minneapolis or LA?
Oh, my God.
And I just went, oh. And yeah, like, I didn't think of that before I got here, you know.
Right.
So I was just going, yes, we'll approach Paisley Park. We'll do the whole thing. Well, anyway, COVID hits, right? So we've had
still
to
time.
Postpone that for now. There's still time. Either way, you know.
So did you start playing like high school bands or middle school, or were you still pursuing?
Yeah. Oh yeah. No. I'm a fan of all the kids in my neighborhood.
Wow.
My buddies that I grew up with. And so the drummer, the guitar player, the bass player, myself, was the first thing, you know, first version of the band. We also had a trumpet player for a little while. And then we switched
ahead of time right there.
Yeah. Then we switched bass players. And then later on, as we got into high school, the nucleus of that band stayed together. The second bass player was still with us. And then we got another like amazing guitar player in the band. This kid who was maybe just a year ahead of us in school, but he was from another neighborhood, like way over in Minneapolis. We were in like one of the suburbs nearby, and we found him through another friend of mine, introduced us to him. And I just said, we got to get this guy in the band. He's amazing. He was 15 and could play his ass off.
Like,
I mean, this guy sounded like Hendrix.
Wow.
He could do Hendrix. He could do, you know, just about, you know, Clapton. He could do anybody. He could emulate these guys. He was a prodigy. His parents were both Las Vegas musicians, live musicians, as it turns out. So he was well trained at a young age by his parents. And that was it. So then after high school, that was when I was still playing in cover bands for a couple more years. And then I auditioned for Prince when I was 20.
Wow. Tell me what that audition was like. I'm getting goosebumps already. This is crazy.
Yeah, he... I walked into Pepe Willie's basement. I don't know. I'm sure some people have heard of Pepe Willie.
Yeah.
Who was one of Prince's mentors. And was he just released his new book, by the way, if anyone's interested. It's out there. And his biography. Autobiography, I should say. And so we were rehearsing in Pepe's basement, 1978. This is October 1978. I walk into the basement to... meet everybody, but Prince isn't there yet. It's just that all the other band members are there except Prince.
And you'd heard of him or?
No. I had his first album. I knew all about Prince by then. You know, I had a copy of his album. I knew Bobby Z already from many years ago. Bobby who introduced me to Prince's music.
Wow.
Because Bobby was like working for Prince's first manager, Owen, as an assistant, kind of like an assistant at that time. That's how Bobby got in to be Prince's drummer. So I knew Bobby from years ago. We both went to the same school district also, and our parents knew one another. Each parents knew each other growing up. So there were a couple occasions where I met Bobby along the way for some special events that both of our parents participated in together, to fundraising events. Apparently that's what those were about. But I was only like 8 years old, I think, the first time I met Bobby. But anyway, so I met him a few times over the years. And then he introduced me to Prince's music about a year before Prince was signed to Warner Brothers.
Wow.
So that's when I said to him, I said, well, what's going to happen with him? He said, well, we're trying to get him a record deal. Work for the Prince's manager right now. And I go, oh, cool. Let me know what happens, because if he does, even if he doesn't, I still want to meet him. I think he's amazing because I heard his demos at that point, you know.
Right.
And I hadn't heard the first.
He was playing all the instruments, I think.
Yeah, he was doing everything. He was doing everything. That's what was so amazing at that time. He was 19, actually, when he made that demo, about 19, 18 and a half, 19. And, I was amazed because I when Bobby played for me, I said, is this a who's the band? And he goes, it's not a band. It's one guy in the studio. And that's when I just went, whoa, okay, that's really different. And then he goes, and he's your age. You guys are the same age. I go, he's only 19? He goes, yeah. I go, that's unheard of. I said, that's unheard of. That's just not, that's never been done. it's not even normal. It's just never been done before to that point in history. The only other artists that I knew at that time that were going in the studio by themselves to record everything practically was
Wonder, maybe
Stevie, but even Stevie had other people around him. But Stevie was at least writing and producing early, very young, like Prince. And then Todd Rundgren.
Oh, wow, really? I didn't know that.
Todd was a studio wizard like Prince and played everything. And you know, that album, A Wizard, A True Star, was pretty much all him.
Wow.
In the studio writing and producing at very, you know, at the age of, you know, probably 21, 22.
I didn't know that. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, okay. So I walk down Pepe Willie's basement. Prince shows up. We, you know, hi, nice to meet you. Da, da, da. He goes, so did you learn the song So Blue off the first album? Because that's all that was out was that. And I said, well, yeah, you know, I listened to that song, but no, I didn't learn it. I didn't know I was supposed to learn that one. I worked on Soft and Wet and Just As Long As We're Together and one of the other ones I can't remember now. And he goes, well, don't worry about it because there's no keyboards on it anyway.
He was testing you. He was testing
me. Testing me right off the bat. But I didn't fail it too badly because I said, well, I listened to that one, but I didn't learn it. You know, so I didn't let on that I knew keyboards were in it or not or whatever, you know.
No, that was
good. Maybe you wanted to try it with keyboards. I mean, since it was all guitar, really, that song.
Right.
Maybe you wanted to add piano. And I thought, oh, shit, I should have learned the chord progression. But anyway, So the audition apparently went well enough that, you know, 3 weeks later I got the call back, you know, to come and join the group.
But when you started playing, were you getting any signs, or was he like just poker face the whole time, or were you kind of getting like a warmth when you were playing together? Because I mean, I feel like anytime you play music with somebody, it's like an opening of your vibes and connection. You know what I mean? It's like an instant connection.
There was definitely chemistry for sure, and yeah, so there it definitely worked. I felt it. He felt it. And yeah, it worked. You know, he could see that I could keep up with him and improvise stuff on the spot.
I'm sure he wanted to feed off that. You know, it's like every great artist wants to be in great company. So
exactly. I want to be able to jam and, you know, well, here's a new chord progression. And I'll teach it to you quick. Okay. And I'll solo over that, you know, whatever, you know.
Right.
Just like, it's like jazz, you know.
And your influences at that time, like, you know, because Prince is a major influence over so many musicians. But for you, was it like Bill Evans? Was it jazz guys? Was it funk guys? Was it guys like Professor Longhair?
It was everything because, by the time I was about 14, that's when I requested to be studying with a jazz teacher. And I knew one that I wanted to work with because I knew some other keyboard players that were studying with that guy, and they were all great players. I mean, amazing players. And more than one of them went on to have national attention and tour with big name artists. So my dad said, sure, we'll hook you up. And so I took the bus once a week, Harbor House bus, and went to downtown Minneapolis and took lessons. And, wow. And again, I always look at it back on it and go, yeah, if I'd have just applied myself a little bit harder, you know, it's funny. But by the time I got old, you know, like 4 years, or what was it, 5 years later is when I joined Prince. So that I had that 5 years of jazz improv and chordal progression knowledge and all that stuff.
So were you like learning more bebop stuff? Were you doing like 70s?
Yeah, kind of, you know, it's like here, yeah, they had me working out of the fake book. They, you know, it's called the fake book, and there were more than one edition of those, and playing standards and learning all that stuff. And then all the while I'm playing in my cover band in high school, junior high and high school.
Wow.
All the way through. In fact, you know, in my senior year of high school, I did join another group that was touring the Midwest, but you know, we were cover current top 40 rock band. That's what we did. And then the following year, I joined another one that was doing all R&B primarily and disco, because disco came in at that time. So we did everything off of Saturday Night Fever.
Wow. So you kind of had the groove. You had the groove in you.
We played lots of Steely Dan.
Oh,
you know, yes. All that stuff.
Right.
So I was singing it. I was playing it. I was cutting my teeth on it, you know, and it was really something else. So by the time I got to Prince, I was really ready with my chops were there and everything. And I was starting to write at that time. And I was writing with a couple other people, too, that were doing some original fusion jazzy stuff, that, you know, recordings.
Right.
But then, you know, there was actually one other opportunity right before Prince that I could have taken, which was a group called Daisy Dillman, which was the top country rock band in the Midwest, and they had a national recording deal at that time. Brand just newly signed, and they were going to go places, right? They in fact, they should have been the next Eagles, but I don't know what happened. They never, they did gain some national status, but they never got like huge, you know, but they're still play a little bit these days, but they were great. And they wanted to hire me. And then the audition with Prince showed up, and I ended up going that direction, which obviously was probably the better choice.
And 3 weeks went by, you get the call. Did Prince mm-hmm. call you, or did his manager call you? Who called you? Was it Bobby?
I believe it was Bobby who called me.
Got the gig, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were like, I don't know what to expect now.
Right.
And did Prince want to like rehearse the band and kind of like just really start writing and start doing pre-production? Or was it kind of like you were playing live gigs and playing some of the old record that he just released the year before?
No, we had to learn the first album all the way through. And then once we debuted that material for a showcase gig in Minneapolis for the Warner Brothers team, including the president, you know, Mo Austin and all those guys, the head of a, and then the A&R guys, you know, they all came out from LA to see that show. And that was in late January or mid January of 79. So I'd only been in the band a couple months. I mean, we didn't rehearse that long, maybe 2.5 months to get ready for that.
I got to ask you a question. This is just for me because I'm so curious about this. Walk me through what a Prince rehearsal is like. I've always wanted to know what a Prince rehearsal is like.
Okay. It had a routine, that's for sure. And the routine was come in, warm up with the jam session, which was invariably recorded also.
Wow.
We would record them. Oh, yeah. We recorded everything. I used to have in those days, I had a boom box, you know, that could record. So that was the way I could remember what we'd do at rehearsals. But anyway, Prince, he would run that for at least an hour or more, you know, maybe an hour and a half of that.
Wow. Maybe
sometimes two. And then start in with working on and running through songs. But he always wanted you to learn your parts at home and come to rehearsal prepared. He didn't really.
I think that's what every band leader wants.
Yeah. He doesn't want you. He doesn't want you showing up not knowing your stuff.
And so would he just like dig into the middle of a song? Would you play the whole thing? This is stuff that fascinates me because this is how I work with my band too. So I'm so fascinated by this.
Well, sometimes, you know, like, There were a few times when I'd show up and I just wasn't tight yet, or I didn't have it down. And the way that I would work is I would write chord charts for myself, because I learned that in my jazz training, how to read chord charts and write them out. So Prince never did this. He never provided chord charts to anybody. It was all ear. Everything was done by ear. So I could keep – I always had a guide post handy for the first, you know, several days of learning a new song or in rehearsal, or, you know, and sometimes it would take up to a week for me to memorize the song, even though I could read the chart, but there would be times when I didn't memorize it as quick. It depended on the difficulty or how much was going on and what I had to learn. As time progressed, I got better at learning faster though, and being able to retain and play things more quickly without having to rely on charts. But, yeah, that's how I always would start rehearsals for any album or tour, anything. It was always I had my own charts to follow. I recorded everything.
Wow.
And even at shows, he rehearsed at sound checks and would change the show while we were on tour. Yeah, pretty regularly.
Like he would just say, we're going to do this new intro on a tune.
Exactly. And transition that goes between this song and that song. And then we're introducing this song. We're going to change the order of the songs, or we're going to add this song to the set and take this one out. You know, so that went on all the time. And then I'd record it and go in the dressing room before the show and listen to make sure I could remember what we just did. And all the band members would do that. But I'll never forget when the band transitioned from the Revolution to the new MPG for the Sign of the Times tour, which, of course, everyone knows I was involved with that. Those people did not realize what was about to happen to them.
You knew.
I knew. I tried to warn them. But they saw it, you know, they thought, oh, well, we got the show down in Minneapolis now after rehearsing for 2.5 months to get ready for the tour, blah, blah, blah. And I said, but just wait. When we're out, he's going to change the show while we're out there. Oh, okay, well, that's cool. You know.
And would he rehearse, like, little things, like dynamics, like hits, stuff like that?
Of course. And he created hand signals and all kinds of cues and all kinds of stuff and verbal cues, you know, and so when he would started doing show changes on tour, then everybody's like, we'd do it, and then we get back in the dressing room before the show, and they'd all come to me and go, Matt, what did we just do? I don't remember. And I go, I taped it. Well, can we listen to it? why would I need to share that with you? You memorized it, right? I messed with them, right?
Good, as you should.
Yeah. And this is you know, Miko Weaver, Levi Caesar, Bonnie Boyer.
Heavy cats.
Yeah, Sheila E., you know, Eric Leeds was usually pretty good. He was a genius. So he remembered everything. Although he would take notes. I come to think of it, I shouldn't say that. Eric, if you see this, I remember you took notes. Okay, so anyway, yeah, that's how it worked. And that's the only way I could get by from show to show when the changes were done, you know.
Was there a show for you, like the most amazing show that you played with the band, either with either lineup or with Prince, or it was just like everybody was firing on all four cylinders? Was there has to be a show that you were like, this was magnetic.
I don't know. I mean, it's funny. Every version of the band, of our group, going from the beginning to when I left, they all had amazing shows.
That's insane.
It's too difficult to pick a favorite for me because they all had their strengths and all that, you know. So.
And was there ever a moment where, let's say, something didn't go right, you know, that like Prince, maybe he called an audible and it kind of didn't go
that,
as
that well. Happened. That right. Could happen. Sure, there were things, and then he wasn't happy about that. You know, there were technical problems here and there that would happen from time to time. He really didn't like that and didn't understand when that stuff would happen. He'd say, "I can't have that. What's going on?" I go, "Hey, that it's a technical issue that was unforeseen and couldn't have been helped."
Right, and he's like, "I can't process that,
and I can't guarantee you that it won't happen again."
Right. Of course.
But we'll do our best to not, because technology in those days could be, wait a minute, though.
Of course.
And we were always cutting edge and always having new stuff come in, and you couldn't predict how things were going to do on the road.
Did you ever see him getting a little bit maybe frustrated or just impatient just with either the process of making music or making a record or anything like that? Was he just like, cool as a cucumber? Because he, in every kind of capacity that I've seen him, whether it's you know, on a show, on a stage, or in like a, you know, recording environment, you know, he's always just cool. He's always just laid back and has his, you know, he's kind of like making little jokes, and like I've never seen a stressed out Prince, you know. But I'm sure you've had to have seen some part of the creative process that was maybe either stifling him, or where he was trying to, maybe it was a rewrite or like a recording or, you know, something in a show, anything like that, that you can recall where he was like impatient, maybe with like a guitar tone or a sound or anything like that.
Not much. No.
He just had it all together. That's how I imagine him.
For the most part, yeah.
Well, tell me what recording was like as a group when you were, because like some of those records that you guys made, I mean, they are time capsules for the Minneapolis sound, for music in general. I mean, it's like in music, like New Orleans has a pulse, LA has a pulse, New York has a pulse. You guys in that time were the pulse. I mean, there wasn't a lot of music in any other city that was as vibrant, as iconic, as eclectic, and as, you know, distinguished, you know, as far as the musicians and the caliber of playing and the songwriting and arrangements, all of that.
So here's the thing about Minneapolis, and it's been too under-recognized as a possible hub of talent, much like Nashville, LA, New York, Chicago, Nashville?
Yeah. Yes.
Austin, Texas now. But, you know, you don't think, Miami has a thing, but there's Atlanta got to be known for hip hop for quite a while.
Right.
It still is. But anyway, yeah, the so-called Minneapolis sound finally came to be. But, you know, prior to that, there were quite a few groups and artists that came out of the Minnesota area too, but at that time there was a lot of musicians that weren't affiliated with Prince that knew him or had worked with him or didn't know him but had every just as much talent too as Prince in some respects, you know, to they that could have been recognized more.
Well, that's what I feel like. That sound, it was just everybody within that city kind of bouncing off each other. And yeah, it just like it was a climax in that, you know, Prince of the Revolution.
Exactly. It's not a big city, obviously. I mean, back then, the actual, I remember the city itself was about 435,000 people there, about it for, you know, if you take just that. And then you add the suburbs on and St. Paul, which was the sister city of, obviously. If you put it all combined back then, you had 1.5 million people, something like that. Now it's more like 3 since that time. But
wow,
we're still not one of the biggest metropolitan areas in the United States because we're up north. It's cold. You know, we just had snow today. People are like, I'm not living there.
That's it.
Oh, no. And Prince used to say, they'd say, Prince, why are you staying in Minneapolis? Because it keeps the riffraff out.
That's right. He says, the cold keeps the bad people
exactly
out.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it does, but regardless, that's not fair to say, but yeah, that was Minneapolis has you know, got a lot more recognition now because of Prince and Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and
Morris the Time, you know, all the guys, yeah,
all that stuff. The Peterson family, you know.
You know, it's crazy. Like I've met Peterson. Prince once, and I've met Michael Bland, you know, in the airport one day.
Yeah.
It's like each one of you are like these iconic musicians that it's like, I think it's like, I kind of look at all the musicians in Prince's bands, plural, as like, that's what every musician strives for, is like trying to make music on that level, to be a musician on that level. Tell me what like your routine was just to keep up with, you know, your chops, either on the road, were you practicing like when you, you know, were on the road?
No, just kind of like, I was lazy.
That's crazy.
I I'd only applied myself even more, I wonder where I'd be. But no, here's the thing. When you're on tour and you've learned the show, and you're on the tour bus or you're flying, you know, I mean, yeah, in those days I had a little portable keyboard. I could take a little Casio in my hotel room and a little 4-track cassette tape. And yeah, and I did some writing. I did some things while I was out there. But then Prince would always find a regular studio and go in or say and bring us in to do sessions or whatever if we were on the road. Not regularly, but every once in a while. But he was always taking off and recording somewhere without us. He didn't need us.
Just doing pre-production on his own.
Whatever. Yeah, anywhere, you know. But and then he'd say, okay, I need you in there for the session, blah, blah, blah. But so... Excuse me. I was writing with a couple people too at that time outside of Prince, just to try to get some songs placed in publishing catalogs, you know, or for other artists. I was attempting that in the mid to late 80s. I was trying to get, and we got a songwriting partner that I was working with. We had some opportunities that came our way, but they didn't really amount to anything. But we got close, you know. They wanted us to do like publishing deals and write 50 songs a year and get money and blah, blah, blah. But I was touring too much with Prince, and he was touring with other major artists too. And we couldn't do it.
It's hard to stay organized when you're touring like that and performing constantly. It's a grind. So like the fact of like even putting that other hat on, that's too much. Like I'm not writing when I'm on the road. I may like practice riffs and then remember them and then come back and really flush it out. But I'm not writing when I'm on the road.
Not as much. But Prince did. He wrote. He was always writing. You know, he was more disciplined that way than anyone I knew.
Tell me what like it being in the studio with him was like. Like, were you guys collaborating, finding sounds, or
absolutely, yeah, sure.
And it was like any kind of influences, or like, you know, do you remember any certain like sessions where you're like, oh man, I'm digging whatever this is, you know?
Absolutely. And then there were songs that I didn't care for too. You know, that, you know, and but he would, it would end up on the album and be, oh, and then it would grow on me. It's weird. You know, some Prince songs on first listen, I would go, okay, where's the hit?
Wow. You know,
And then, but then, like I said, you know, it would grow on you and go, wait a minute, this is way cooler than I first heard it, you know.
What was one of your favorite songs that you guys recorded that you worked on that you were like, man, this is slamming?
Well, oh boy, that's a tough one.
I know you have a lot. There's a lot of songs.
Probably ones that he was generous enough to give me co-writes on, you know, like Computer Blue and America and It's Going to Be a Beautiful Night and Dirty Mind and 17 Days, you know, those tracks, stuff like that. And then I played on a number of things as well as a session player, but the song When Doves Cry to me is a work of genius.
Yes.
You know, and because he did something that was really unusual, and that was to not have a bass guitar or a bass synthesizer doing anything in there except for the kick drum, which created the groove, gave it the
And it was a machine, too. It wasn't.
Yeah, it was the Lynn drum machine. But it gave it this raw feel. But then the vocals and granted the keyboard parts, it's very simple, you know, until you get to the end when that iconic synthesizer solo happens that he did, that he performed.
Wow.
In the studio. But he did it in such a way that he used a studio trick. Now, granted, he can play that fast in reality, but because he was writing it in the studio a specific way and he wanted to give it a certain tone, he slowed the analog tape machine, 24 track, down. Sorry, my phone.
It's all right.
With me, and I left it upstairs, and my phone is going off. Okay, so my iWatch is going beeping. So he slowed the tape down to half speed. So if it's in the original key, it goes one octave lower.
Right.
He played it. You know, on the keyboard where he wanted it to be, but really slow while he was writing the part and punching in whatever he had to do. And then he sped it back up again to the original. And it just went, it's very classical. It's very Mozart-y, Bach thing. And then I had to learn that in real time.
You're like, please.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's really fast.
He's like, just play it. You can
and
do
classical. That's where my training comes in.
That's right. I was about to say, it's like you got all those fugues down somewhere.
Right.
That's so funny. And did you ever find, because a lot of those recordings you were all doing to analog tape, all of them mostly, I guess, until probably past New Power Generation, right? You weren't doing digital till way past that, right? So all the analog stuff, did you kind of find that was it all people in a room kind of capturing the sound, or was it kind of like one-on-one with Prince? You're laying your stuff down, next guy comes in, laying stuff down.
It was either that, or he did a lot of stuff where we all played live together, too. Full-on rhythm section stuff, so you get that feel.
Did he track vocals live with the band, too?
No.
Wow. No. So he would do that separately. He would get the groove.
He would do a scratch vocal as a guidepost, but no, he would always sing alone in the studio. In fact, he would always dismiss his engineers when he tracked vocals, and he would have the microphone in the control room with him controlling the tape machine himself and punching himself in and out.
Wow.
Nobody there.
Because he just didn't want anybody around to hear any bad notes, or he just wanted the creative space. Wow, that's so awesome. That's incredible. Did you ever, I've seen him many times, and one thing I'm just always blown away with is his guitar tone and his guitar chops. There had to be moments where you were just like, this guy is sick. And
No. He's
sicker and sicker.
I'm sorry. I personally think he should be in the top five.
I agree.
Top 5 to 10 guitar players. He should be in there with Hendrix, you know, the Rolling Stone. I mean, Rolling Stone, of course, rated him very high. I can't remember which number he came at, but to me, he's there, like, top 10.
I mean, he's like Hendrix reincarnated in a lot of ways, but kind of taking different directions.
Oh, no.
He's jazz influence.
He's his own entity.
Yes.
Unto himself. And, you know, like everything, it's subjective and the critics are going to do what they're going to do. But from a technical playing standpoint and the way he approached the guitar, his tone, like you said, his tones, the fluency of the way he played, his choices were, yeah. I mean, there's, sorry, no.
Insane.
One of the baddest MFs on the planet.
Yep.
No question. No question.
Just like yourself, man. Let's talk about the 1999 organ sound, because they're live. That had to be one of your favorite favorite riffs, favorite jams to play. It just had to be, because, you know, it just elevated every show, every concert, every crowd to like ballistic, you know, ballistic.
It is. It is a very great, nice energy song. Great message.
Did you use an Oberon? What was the organ that you used on 1999 when you played it live?
Well, 1999 really wasn't an organ. It was actually the Arp Omni synthesizer.
Wow. See, I didn't know this. The Arp Omni. Mm-hmm. Wow. And I assume it had like tons of layers. Dude, I got to tell you, like, I'm asking all these questions that I've just been dying to know. So I'm like a little kid in a candy shop. Like, you even telling me all this stuff, I'm just kind of.
It's the Arp Omni layered with the Arp Omni. But it's,
so still, it's just how many layers you think were on?
He probably double tracked it.
Wow. Because it sounds so big.
It's really fat. Yeah.
I'm still chasing Prince organ sound and Prince keyboard sounds, because, like,
everybody is. That's why they come to me to find out what we did.
Because they're epic. They're totally epic. That's why I'm like, we got to collaborate on songs, because you created a sound that is literally, it was a time capsule, and it's preserved. It's like everybody still, you know, you hear Kanye West flashing lights. He's emulating all those Prince organ sounds on that. And it's like, it still doesn't come close to all the stuff that you guys did. So, you know, I assume when you were on the road or when you were in the studio, you were just like, just submerged with all kinds of keyboards and synths. Tell me what gear was, you know, at your disposal, either on the road or in the studio, or what your preferences were.
Oh boy. You know, every year I was bringing the cutting edge stuff to Prince every year. He kind of like stopped looking at certain pieces of gear for a while, but and just relying on me or Lisa to bring in stuff to show him, because he's so busy writing all the time, or, you know, whatever. You know, I don't say that 100%. There were still some things he was exploring, like the Fairlight. When that came around, he latched onto the Fairlight CMI. But I was always bringing new stuff in, and he usually would like it.
So you would just like introduce a sound or some piece of technology to him.
Yeah, no, I was bringing new keyboard gear every year, pretty much anything that was cutting edge that was really good, we adopted pretty quickly. And so we would always get the first dibs on some of the factory sounds, and then we would mess with those and modify them a little so we didn't sound like everybody else if they were copying those. And, you know, got into learning programming of those machines, you know.
You told me this story on the phone, but we got to have our listeners listen to this. So tell us the story of how you became Dr. Fink. Like, how did the outfit become part of the show? Because it is also one of the iconic parts of the Revolution.
Well, you know, the early tour that we did in 79 with Rick James, we were the opening act on his Fire It Up tour. This was the tour where the two human beings dressed as joints come on stage. smoking joints.
So crazy.
Like costumes. And as soon as that song Fire It Up came up on in the show, the entire arena lit up with marijuana.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. And we'd be down in this, you know, playing the southern United States. We'd be in Alabama, and the police knew that Rick James was going to be smoking weed on stage. And they'd come backstage before the show and say, "Nah, Rick, you can't be smoking that marijuana on stage tonight, because if you do, we're going to have to take you in." And that was what they said. I never forget it. I was standing right there. And so Ian listened.
Of course not. He's Rick James.
Anyway, so third show into the tour, we're playing in Chicago, and Rick plays this song in his show called Bustin' Out of L7. Anybody heard of that one?
Yeah, of course.
Sure you have, sure. Okay, so he's wearing a jail suit, and I'm wearing a jail suit during our set. When we're the opening act, I'm wearing the black and white stripes. He comes out in the black and white stripes. Prince sees this and goes, oh, boy, well, we can't have that. So he talks to me after the show. He goes, hey, I just realized that he's wearing that jail suit during that song, and you're got your outfit, and he's the headliner. You're going to have to ditch it. You're going to have to ditch your look. Yeah. That's what he said. I said, really? Why, what's the big deal? He goes, yeah, it's redundant. You know, he's the headliner. He's coming out and doing that song. He's wearing the jail suit, and you're wearing a jail suit. We can't have that. Can't have you in the same outfit. And I go, great. Now, is he telling you this? Is Rick coming to you telling me I can't be wearing a jail suit? He goes, no, that's not it. No, it's not. It's me. It's all me. I go, okay. What am I going to wear? He goes, I don't know. You got any other ideas? Do you have any other ideas when you were concocting the jail suit guy? I said, well, yeah, but remember what I wore in the early videos like last year? And I had that great looking, you know, satin tuxedo, the gold and very Elton Johnny, you know, a tux and tail look. He goes, ah, that's been done. It's cheesy. I go, oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. I go, how about a guy in a doctor suit? I was thinking of surgeon's outfit. He went, what? I go, yeah, a guy in a doctor suit. That was my second choice behind the guy in the jail suit. He goes, a doctor suit, huh? Wow. And then all of a sudden, like the light bulb went right over his head, you know, like you see in the cartoons. He goes, okay, let's try the doctor thing tonight. And he sent out our wardrobe gal to get real scrubs and everything at a uniform shop for doctors, and they got all the doctor accessories for me, you know, with the stethoscope and the mask. Wow. And the surgeon's cap and the whole shebang. I even had one of those mirror things.
I've seen the reflector mirror. You know? Yeah, totally.
So that was it. So I became the doctor the next show.
Well, you know, it's funny that one move, it kind of like defined what your character was, because it's like, you know, I look for that character every time I look for old footage on YouTube. Mm. I'm always like, oh, there he is. You know what I mean? And the funny thing is, I went to Paisley Park and I did the tour, and I was just so enamored with the studio and all of the gear. And this was one of the first things that made me kind of fascinated. I was like, I've got to find Matt Fink, because one of the tour guides was like, yeah, I was giving one of these tours and Matt Fink, AKA Dr. Fink, was in here, and he was like, hey, let me see this keyboard, because this keyboard had a certain mark on it that, you know, I remember leaving on it. You said you looked for it, and he was like, yep, this is the keyboard. There was some marking or something that you had remembered that had been on that keyboard for recording sessions forever. And it was something that you remembered, some marking. So I was like, you know what, this guy, he knows the identity of instruments, the kind of like the, you know, it's when you look at stuff like that's around you, instead of, you know, you can get lost in music, but when you're actually taking notice of the gear, the people, you're present, you know? So it just made me want to meet you, because I'm like, this guy's aware, like, to know of a marking that's on an instrument that's maybe 20, 30, 40 years old. That's just crazy. Most people don't remember stuff like that. They yeah. wouldn't even on their own piece of gear, you know?
Very true.
Let me ask you this. Any one-on-one moments that you had with Prince that made you think, this is something I'll remember for the rest of my life, either musically or a conversation or traveling?
Yeah, I remember the day late in the 1999 tour, he sat down to have breakfast with me one day at the hotel, and he mentioned that he was going to make a movie and what my thoughts were about that and that the band was going to be in it with him. And I went, my jaw just went, huh? What? What did you just say? Yep, we're gonna do a movie. I go, really? He goes, yep. I go, wow, okay. Keep me in the loop.
And it's only like one of the most iconic movies of all time.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how he came to me with the idea that we were going to do a film. And he wanted to know what I thought of that. Of course, I said, well, sounds like that would be, that's pretty cool if we can pull that off. Why not?
And I heard the Purple Rain, the actual recording was a live take at First Avenue. Is that true?
That's true, yeah.
The band was all just like one take and you guys captured what that, that's insane.
But we also overdubbed real string players on it.
Yeah, that I can, but it's still, that's not like, that's like more of an effect versus mm-hmm. like the band was mm-hmm. really jamming. I mean, I listen to that tune at least several times a week just because it's just still one of those songs. It's like, I never get tired of listening to it. I never get tired of the performances, the arrangements. I hear new things in it every time. Nice. Tell me what it was like just working on that song or what the energy was like when you guys filmed it, recorded it live.
Well, it was really hot. It was like 90-something degrees out and high humidity in Minneapolis at First Avenue Club. And it was packed house. So the air conditioning wasn't keeping up, and we were just drenched from the minute we got on stage. So not only were we drenched and sweaty, and the audience was sweaty, but we poured our heart and soul into it, and that's what came out, you know. And then they recorded it on the truck sitting out in the alley next to the club, and that was it.
You
know, that was
you did some great playing on that track. I mean, it's. It's like some of my favorite piano playing out of any of the stuff he's done because it's just, you hear like what you're playing against what he's playing. It's just beauty on so many levels. So like, how did you kind of like think about playing that? Were you kind of just feeling the moment or was it something that you guys rehearsed? Was it just an improv thing that just kind of happened in the moment?
Well, it was improv during rehearsal, and then I adopted what I improvised and used it and learned it later from the rehearsal recordings to make it work that way.
Because those parts are, like, iconic. I mean, they're just everything about that record, the movie, the sound, everything. But that particular song, I mean, the performance on everybody's, like, pocket, playing, improvising, arrangement – it's through the roof. It is through the roof. Did you guys know that you captured lightning in a bottle when it happens?
It felt good, but you just don't know what's going to happen with the audience once it's out there. But you hope that it will touch a nerve, and it did. So that's what.
When was the first time he brought that song in that you heard that song that you remember?
Well, he came in with the chord progression, and then he taught that to the group, and then he said, okay, let's just start working it out. And he didn't have the lyrics down yet or the melody to the song yet. He just had the chord progression. He had a basic idea for it. And I'll never forget, I started playing during the jam. I started playing the line that at the very end where he goes up to his falsetto and he's singing, ooh, that whole thing. Yeah. I was actually playing that line on the piano at rehearsal.
Wow.
And then he started to sing it.
Oh, yeah. My God. You just gave me goosebumps.
Yeah. That's how that happened. He adopted it. So that's how, like why he liked to jam or to mess around and improvise on these songs. Because, you know, you could capture some magic happening.
That's every time you hear that song, yeah. I mean, I'm sure you watch the Super Bowl and you're seeing a whole stadium singing that. And you're right. Like, man, I came up with that. That
little anthem was just something that I did, and it came out in the song.
Matt, you are a tremendous soul, and I look forward to working with you on some music in the very near future. And I don't want to take up any more of your time because I know you're in Minneapolis time.
Well,
thank you.
Can I say one more thing before
of
I go?
Of course, absolutely.
I want your audience to kind of know what we're up to here in Minneapolis now. I didn't really delve into it enough at the beginning.
Oh, please, please.
But so we have a new record label called V Records, and we have four signed artists on the label now. And one of those artists is the head of the company, JoJo Brim's son, Nico Brim. And he's really getting a lot of traction right now. And then one of the other artists is my son, Maxwell Fink, who goes by the stage name of Max Millie.
Awesome.
It's M-I-L-L-I, so you can catch him on Spotify or iTunes and anywhere, you know, streaming. And then we have Lil Crush from Minneapolis, and MJ Songstress, who's based in New York, and she's an amazing singer. Oh my gosh, she was!
I love that you're still cultivating music on a generational level. It's amazing.
Yeah, and then we have another artist by the name of Kev Rogers, also out of New York, who's also on board with us too. So yeah, it's a new company. We have there's management for artists with this company, and that's headed by JoJo Brim and his brother Jimmy.
What's the name of the company? One more time.
V as in Victor. V Media Entertainment.
And is that the website where people can look it up, vmediaentertainment.com?
Yes, but the website's, like I said, this is a very new company. The website isn't quite there yet, but the parent company, which is ADX Labs here in Minneapolis, is our parent company.
Where can people find you on Instagram or Facebook or
Matt Fink? Matt Fink 1 on Instagram, Dr. Fink 1980 on Twitter, Matthew Fink on Facebook, and the Dr. Fink fan page on Facebook as well.
You are such a badass, man.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, but like I said, these up and coming artists are all wonderful, and my son was brought on board by the head people. There's no nepotism involved. I want people to know that.
Oh, you know what? It's even if there was, you are one of the people that has the gene in you that it should be passed and it should keep on being cultivated because music is in you, man. And, you know, we're all the benefactors for music you create and any generational thing that comes next, you know?
And my son, who's 25 now, I feel like he has surpassed me as a songwriter by far at this point. He's so prolific. Like when I was that age, I'm co-writing a few things with Prince. Yeah, I'm doing a few things on my own, blah, blah. But this guy's got like several albums done already that are coming out. I mean, it's ready to go. It's really good, and it's good. It's really quality material. It's right in the pocket with what you're hearing these days from a pop and hip-hop standpoint of music. You know,
Well, then we're all three of us are going to have to collaborate on some music, man.
Sure, why not?
Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
Matt, you are a tremendous guest, and thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview. This was a dream come true for me. I've been wanting to pick your brain forever, as you know, and thank you for taking the time, and let's make some music, man. Let's make some.
I forgot to give one more shout out to the In the Loop TV show, which is part of our thing, our video blog, which is also on YouTube these days, but
it's a
fledgling company. Just want you to know, it's very new.
Okay.
It started out with the My Music streaming service.
Well, you know what?
It's been around a couple years now.
You have an open invitation to come back and promote whatever artists you are bringing up or whatever projects or music things that you have in mind, because you are on that level of legendary status.
As long as we're promoting, I'll bring up one of my artists I've been producing, Michelle Rose.
Please.
Check out Michelle Rose Music on YouTube as well.
Awesome. Matt, this is tremendous. I look forward to making music with you, man. Let's make something happen. And next time, you know, if you ever want to promote any of your artists, shoot me an email and we'll get them on the show too and talk music. Because that's what this is about, man. That's what this is about, putting a spotlight on great artists. So thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for taking the time to talk about all this, because it was a dream come true, man. And we'll make some music very soon, okay?
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Nikki.
Awesome. Have a good night. Get some rest. Be safe. Stay healthy.
Yeah, I'm trying. Thank you.
Cheers, good night. Man. Good night.
Night.